I'd also like to say welcome and welcome back to many of you who've been here on previous occasions and follow more or less the same format as previously, if I can remember correctly. I'm going to begin with a discourse for maybe 45 minutes or so, and then we can maybe have a short break, and then a period of sitting meditation, and then I'll answer any questions or if there's anything you'd like to discuss or put me right about if I make any mistakes. So the teachings of the Buddha are referred to in the Pali language by a number of well-known terms. One of them is ehipassiko, and ehipassiko is rather difficult to translate, and what you'll usually find in English books is the come and see Dhamma or something of that nature. So the idea being that this is a teaching that invites you to come and take a look, put it to the test, and it's certainly not a teaching comprised of dogmas which you are required to believe in. But there are a number of propositions about nature of human life, the nature of the good life, given the fact that our time here as human beings is limited, and as we don't know the extent of that limitation, then a question arises: what's the best way for us to spend the time that we do have? And so the Buddha has many suggestions with regards to that kind of question. Given an initial interest in spiritual development, where the Buddha does tend to be quite authoritative, is in his explanation of various stages of spiritual life in the practice of meditation, very precise psychological definitions of particular experiences that meditator will go through, what enlightenment means. Not in a sort of hazy kind of New Age way, but very particularly in terms of the psychological, irrevocable psychological changes that take place when one reaches a certain level of development, almost what we might call quantum leaps of consciousness. So the within this path that the Buddha taught, which I often refer to as an education system rather than a belief system, the Buddha goes into great detail as regards both those practices, both those attitudes, values, perceptions, thoughts that support and those which hinder the progress of the aspirant. And I think today I'm going to talk about a group of those. If any of you have read any of the Buddhist scriptures and the discourses, you may well have noticed this particular style of teaching in which there are groups of two, groups of threes, groups of fours, groups of fives, and apart from its obvious role in facilitating memory, these groups are not randomly chosen, but in many cases there are very interesting and subtle links between the different members of a group, and they are often what we may call them a holistic system of either of virtues or even of vices. Now, one of these groups of three consists of three negative qualities. One is called tanha, or in Thai tanha. One is called mana, and one is called ditti. So tanha is craving, and mana is conceit, and ditti is views. So these are three mental qualities which retard the spiritual process, spiritual life. So we call them retarding agents, retardation, something like that. The first one is the one that you probably have heard of, the lot, craving or tanha. Now, before going into too much detail on this, I think it's worth emphasizing this very important point that Buddhism distinguishes between different kinds of desire using this basic standard of whether something is wholesome or unwholesome. The word wholesome or unwholesome is translation, again, excuse me if there's too much of these technical terms, but it is worth learning a few of these. There's kusala and akusala. Now, wholesome or kusala dhammas means those qualities which lead to freedom, or at least a lessening of the power of negativity, based around three kind of poles of negativity, which we summarize as greed, hatred, and delusion. Okay. Unwholesome or akusala dhammas are those qualities which partake of and enhance, strengthen the power of those negative factors of greed, hatred, and delusion. Greed, hatred, and delusion are titles of clusters of mental states. So hatred, for instance, refers to the whole spectrum of negative energy. It includes even the slightest kinds of irritation, and goes right up to the most extreme kind of rage and hatred. So this one word, hatred, here must be understood to be a blanket or an umbrella term for many, many, many different negative mental states. Similarly, greed covers a whole spectrum of mental states, from the most subtle kind of movement towards something with a desire to grasp it, or to become one with it, or to possess it, right to the most extreme forms of grasping or sexual desire or whatever. Delusion, similarly, covers all kinds of mental states which are characterized or exemplified by fuzziness, confusion. It includes things like fear, anxiety, depression, and so on and so forth. So I'll recap there, and so that I'm not losing you. Two kinds of desire, and one kind of desire is unwholesome. That is to say, it is bound up irrevocably with and leads to an increase of the power of greed, hatred, and delusion. The unwholesome kind of desire. Sorry, that was the unwholesome, wasn't it? The wholesome, I'm getting mixed up myself now. So the wholesome is the one which leads to the decrease, gradual elimination, freedom from these negative qualities. Now, the unwholesome kind of desire is what we call tanha. And the wholesome kind of desire has another name, which is not so well known, and that is chanta or kusala chanta or dhamma chanta, which means the will towards dhamma, the will towards truth, the will towards goodness. So when it's the Buddhist teachings are commonly summarized as life is suffering because of desire, that is so much of a condensation of the teaching that it's positively, if that's the right word, it's definitely misleading, because the word suffering here is a very profound term, which maybe I'll go into later on. But the word I want to focus on here is desire, and it has to be made clear that it is the tanha or unwholesome form of desire here that is referred to, and not the wholesome kind of desire. If there's no wholesome kind of desire, then there's no spiritual life, and there's no effort. Then you can just sort of vegetate and just put up with whatever happens as best you can. But the Buddhist teaching is very far from being a teaching of passivity. In fact, of the words, epithets, which the Buddha chose to define what he was teaching, he said this is a teaching of effort. So it's a teaching of all the different religious teachings in India at that time. It was one which was distinguished by its emphasis on effort and the fact that human effort is possible and is efficacious. So this was in direct contrast or conflict with teachings that taught that everything's preordained or that happiness and suffering is determined by a heavenly power, for instance. So the kind of desire which is the cause of suffering is the unwholesome kind of desire called tanha. The other kind of desire is not to be abandoned, quite the contrary, it's to be adopted and made much of. Indeed, in the efforts to let go of, to abandon this unwholesome kind of desire, one skillful means to be adopted is to boost and to encourage the wholesome desire. So it's like channeling this energy from the unwholesome channel into the wholesome channel. Now, craving is inseparable from ignorance. So this is again one of the basic, most important propositions that the Buddha made. He said that we don't really understand ourselves or the world that we live in. And of the various forms of misunderstanding which we're subject to, the most important one is the assumption as a kind of basic premise of our existence, of this independent, self-existent entity called me or I. Now, with that fundamental mistake of consciousness, of perception, of thought, then what immediately springs up is craving. Okay? So craving is the desire which is inseparable from the lack of understanding or misunderstanding of what who we are, what life's all about. So that's the bad news, and the good news is that it's something that we can eradicate because if we develop a clear, direct understanding of the way things are, then the foundation for that kind of desire is removed. So craving is divided. Usually there are different ways of doing this, but three kinds of craving. One is sensual craving, another is the craving to become, and the third is the craving to get rid of. So the craving, the sensual craving, is the desire for forms, sounds, odors, tastes, touch, body sensations, and mental activity. So we want something to be happening all the time, and this is based upon an idea that we grow, that we benefit, that we make a gain through pleasant sensual experiences, and that somehow we are made poorer by a lack of the pleasant sensual experiences, or having to put up with experience unpleasant sensual experiences. Here I think you may be able to see that relationship with ignorance that I spoke of just now is that, you know, why do you want that? Why is that movement, that impulsive, instinctive movement towards the sensory world, other than through the unspoken assumption that there is someone here who will benefit from it? So that is there actually this being here who is enriched by sensual experience? This is one of the things that we seek to explore in meditation. So we want to have something going on and as pleasant as possible. Now, when we crave something, what tends to happen is that we value it. We give value to the things we crave, to the extent that people can say, if I don't get that, I don't want to live. Or someone who has some heartbreak or something decides to kill themselves because they've given so much value to that relationship or to the feelings that they derive from that relationship, that they feel that is the essence of who I am, my life, and without it, it's not worth being alive. So this is the process by which we value the things that we crave. And that giving a unrealistic value to the things we crave is the essence of what in Buddhism is called attachment. Okay, so we want, we desire, we feel we need, but the problem is that sensory experience is limited. And we as this body and mind, as the experiences of sensory pleasure, are also limited. As to say that no matter how pleasant an experience might be, if you have it enough, you're going to get bored with it. And before you get bored, you get used to it. And so the initial buzz of experience cannot be sustained indefinitely. You cannot go on enjoying something for very long. And that's built into the nature of existence. Our nervous systems, our physical bodies can't sustain that kind of intense experience for very long at one time. That which is providing the enjoyment is also unsustainable. And a very common experience, as I'm sure you know, is that of diminishing returns. That in the course example of drug addiction, for instance, you find you have to keep increasing the dose of the drug to get the same level of enjoyment. So these are some of the drawbacks or the weaknesses of the search for happiness in the sensual world. Again, I'd like to emphasize that the Buddha wasn't taking a Puritan stance against sensual pleasure, but he was concerned that we should look at it very closely and ask ourselves, does it really give us what we want it to? Because we may find that behind that desire for sensory pleasure, there's actually a desire for a happiness which is unchanging. And if we are indeed seeking a happiness which is unchanging through the pursuit of things that change all the time, then we're going to finally end up with nothing more than frustration. So in the last few years, many of you may know, the subject of happiness has become very fashionable as a subject of scientific studies. There are a number of very good books out there on this subject. I can recommend one that was sent to me recently and won a prize in England called Stumbling on Happiness. I don't know if anyone's read this book. It's a lot of very interesting experiments in there. But one of the recurring results of these studies is found that an increase in wealth has a corresponding increase in happiness only with people who are in a state of fundamental insecurity, meaning that they don't have the basics to sustain themselves physically. They don't have enough food to eat or for their family. They don't have a roof over their head. They don't have clothing. They don't have adequate clothing. They don't have access to medical care when they're sick. So in that case, certainly, you give somebody $10 or $100, it's going to make an appreciable difference to their level of happiness. But what's interesting is once you go beyond that level and someone has no rational need to worry about subsistence, then an increase in wealth has less and less effect on one's happiness level, to the extent that if we're talking larger sums of money, say the difference between I don't know, $500,000, $1 million, $10 million, $100 million, $1,000 million, or Bill Gates, it's hardly significant. It really makes no difference. And this is not some kind of spiritual teaching as a comfort for people who are not at those heady levels of income, but it's something which has been shown again and again and again. So I think there's a good argument that someone who's already financially secure and is spending all their time and all their efforts on making more and more money with the hope that it's going to make them more happy, that they're basically leading a very superstitious life, and one which is to be pitied rather than admired. So you can see that what the Buddha wants us to do is to look at our lives very directly, without preconceptions, but with the recognition that our ability to look at life in a creative, successful way is going to depend, firstly, on the tools of analysis that we have, and the Buddha gives us many such tools and a kind of a map to help us on our way. But also, the Buddha stresses the importance of the training and education of the scientist or of the explorer himself, that if our mind is in its usual very distracted, superficial state, its ability to understand anything in any kind of profound way is severely limited. So there is a need to be developing the powers of the mind to enable this kind of exploration to be successful. The Buddha said that apart from this desire for sensory input, this one of my colleagues came up with a wonderful phrase for this. It's called orificity. It's this kind of obsession with the various orifices of the physical body. If we can go beyond that, there are still other kinds of desire which are equally damaging. And this desire to become, again, of course, posited on the idea of there is someone to become. And this is not a desire rooted to the purely physical and sensual, but it's a desire to be somebody, to be rich, as to be known to be as a rich person, not just the enjoyment of the wealth, but that status, the desire for status, for celebrity, for fame, and so on. So was remember years ago when can't remember the name of the man now, but he which defeats his purpose, I think, because he tried to assassinate George Wallace. I don't know if you remember. And when they caught him, all the police were sort of holding on. He was screaming out something like, "Now I'm a millionth part of history." So this was for him, you know, definitely compensation for having to either be executed or spend the rest of his life in prison, that, you know, he would in some way be remembered and not forgotten. His desire to leave a name for oneself, to be somebody, is of course very strong. And it also reflected in desire to be respected, desire to be loved, desire to mean something to others. So this kind of desire is of course, in some cases, can lead to some very noble actions. It's not a terrible thing. And in many cases, in the political realm, this kind of desire for a good name in history may lead people in power to do some quite good things, at least before they leave office. So it's not always such a bad thing on kind of the macro level, but what we're looking at internally is this desire to become something, and particularly to notice how wherever, whenever that becomes powerful in your mind, then there is suffering. It's inseparable. So craving and suffering, ignorance, they all go together. And the sense of craving for sensual desire, which I went into just now, obviously you have to have a feeling that you lack something. Otherwise, why would you seek to possess it or to enjoy it? Because you feel you lack it. And similarly, the desire to become something, to be somebody else other than who you are, is based on this idea of lack, that you're not who you want to be. And in some cultures in America now, you know, you can be whoever you want to be as a kind of a rallying call. You know, anybody can be the president, you know, if you try hard enough and you have enough money in the bank and enough friends. But the idea of becoming something other than you are is so strong. And this kind of idea can infect spiritual life and lead to something one great teacher referred to as spiritual materialism. This idea of taking on particular spiritual practices because you want to be somebody else other than you are, and you want to be a spiritual person. And so some people can adopt this rather kind of false so-called spiritual persona when they embark on spiritual life and be readily mocked for it, for their pains in many cases. But it is something that can be just a phase, that's something that people will go through if you recognize it. You see, it's not about spiritual life, it's not changing your personality and sort of suddenly that you've got this beautiful kind of kind, gentle, warm, wise, wonderful, charismatic personality, but the spiritual life firstly leads to the elimination of all those personality traits which are based on unwholesome dhammas. But many other, most other personality traits remain. There's no reason why they shouldn't. As I say, you're not trying to be somebody else. You're trying to understand and to be friends with and to be at peace with what there is right now. So it's not, again, this is not the idea as accepting who you are, because you don't know who you are anyway, but because there are certain habits that you have and certain ways of behavior and certain ways of looking at life, and which manifest externally, which are based on wrong thinking, wrong assumptions, delusions, which will just disappear gradually. But if we want to become somebody or something, then we're on the wrong track. This is the basic idea. So, you know, returning to my distinction between two kinds of desire, between the wholesome and unwholesome desire, if you have desire to do good, to help your fellow man, to reduce the amount of injustice or the amount of poverty in society, then that would be considered the wholesome kind of desire and something not at all to be abandoned. But if you desire to be a good person and to be understood to be and respected as a good person, and that this state of goodness becomes your goal rather than the performance of good actions, then you've drifted into the realms of craving. So the last kind of craving is what we call vipava tanha, desire to get rid of, not to have to put up with. And this is perhaps not so obviously a problem when you have you experience something threatening, something dangerous, you want to get away from it. I don't think that there's any question about that. But the mixed up with that very useful instinct for survival that we have as a species, there is this inability to bear with unpleasant experience, unpleasant sensation, which leads us to reject, to push away, to drive away things which in the long run may well be for our benefit. And the for instance, in sitting meditation, any kind of meditation, everyone experiences some physical pain. Everybody experiences unwanted thoughts and perceptions and so on. Now, if you react to those kinds of obstacles with this kind of craving, it actually makes it worse. It doesn't make it better. If you have a pain arising in your legs, in your back or somewhere, and it arises and there's this sense of dissatisfaction and frustration and just want to get up, or you want to change your posture immediately, then you develop very bad habits, and you never are able to develop the ability to sit for any length of time. On the other hand, of course, if you sort of grit your teeth and just going to sit through this and battle with it, then that's also often not the wisest strategy, because you can get very tense and you may be able to maintain physically your position, but mentally your mind's sort of full of heat and resentment and so on. So the idea with sitting meditation is to recognize the kinds of anger, resentment and so on which arise naturally from the experience of unpleasant physical sensation, and to recognize it as simply that, as simply a reaction, and then to gently push onwards for a while. But that if the pain becomes a real distraction and it's not something that you can work with anymore, then you change your posture, recognizing the reason that you've done that. So it's comparable to most kinds of physical exercise, where you don't want to be too gung-ho and you don't want to take it too easy. You want to find this kind of middle way. Mentally, if you have you start having these thoughts about what am I going to have for dinner, and what this person said, and what that, and all these kinds of things arising when you're trying to meditate, and then if you think I don't want to have to think about this, I'm meditating, go away, and that kind of attitude, it's probably the same kind. You get the same kind of response if you were to speak like that to an adolescent child, that they don't take very kindly to it and probably will do whatever they're doing even more than they were doing it before. So again, this is a sense of recognition that this is not what I want to be doing, and then just very gently but firmly put it down. So if you were driving a car, for instance, and you took a wrong turning, then you don't have to get angry with your car or get angry with the street, or you don't even have to get angry with the map, but you simply recognize you're wasting time, you take a U-turn and get back onto the road that you want to follow. And that meditation is similar like that. So these three kinds of desire, the craving for sensual experience, the craving to become, the craving to get rid of, these are the three kinds of craving. And I'm just looking at the clock and I've almost used up the whole time talking about the first one of these three. So, quick, more brief exposition of the other two. Mana, or conceit, is the attachment to ideas vis-a-vis other people that I'm better than they are, I'm superior, or I'm inferior, or we're all the same. So conceit is not restricted just to feelings of superiority. In Buddhist terminology, if you're always putting yourself down and thinking, I'm not as good as he is, she's so much better than I am, so much more intelligent, so much more good-looking, so much more charming, and so on, then this kind of attachment to this sense of being somebody in particular, it's referred to as sort of raising a flag, you know, this is who I am, then this is a real problem in spiritual life, and comparing oneself with others in unhelpful ways. So again, what makes this a little bit more subtle is that at the same time as the effort to recognize and let go of conceit, there is, of course, a recognition of different ability levels. It is not that everyone's on the same level. So if you if you feel that you're better at in your chosen field or in your profession, if you had to make use of your skills that you've perfected in your working life. And I was asked to do the same job. I don't think that it would be conceited for you to think that you'd probably do a better job than I could. So that there's a recognition that some people are better than others at different things. But where it becomes conceit is that it's taken to refer to who you are. I am this, I am that. And also, if you notice the sense of all of us being the same, we're all on the same level, nobody's better than anybody else, I'm as good as you are, you're no better than I am, that can also be a form of conceit in Buddhist teachings. So that's a quick one on conceit. Ditti is views, and in particular, its meaning of attachment to views. And one of the reasons that arguments tend to go on and on and on is because we attach to the view, we identify with the view to the extent that if we acknowledge that our view is incorrect, we feel as if we're acknowledging something uncomfortable about who we are. It's a personal defeat. So the way of practice here is one, to recognize the nature of view, and secondly, not to identify it with so strongly. Understanding the nature of views means that seeing that a view is a compound. That is to say, a view about anything at all is based upon certain conditions. It's based upon the information that you have. It's based on the analysis of the information, the conclusions that you've drawn about the information. And at each stage, it's possible that a mistake could be made. Some of your information could be faulty, or it could come from an unrepresentative source. In the analysis of the information, some bias might have been present, and in the conclusions that you drew from it, you may have made mistakes. So recognizing that, and particularly if you can remember particular occasions when you made those kinds of mistakes, where you didn't get all the information that you needed in order to make a proper analysis, or you took unrepresentative sample, or you made mistakes at other stages along the path, and you remember that, then when you do have an idea, a view about something, then that will temper it and will help you to keep it at arm's length a little bit and not identify with it so much, and not have to fight with other people because of your views, and recognizing to what extent I may be wrong. This is like a mantra that you can repeat, like sort of a TM mantra, whenever you go into a meeting or you're having some kind of dispute with anybody. Whenever you have a few minutes free, you just think, I may be wrong, I may be wrong, I may be wrong. And instead of, I'm right, I'm right, I'm right. Even if you can reduce the frequency of the I am rights just a little bit, it'll probably be quite helpful in your relationships with the people around you. So recognizing the extent in the world today, to what degree the world is in such turmoil because of attachment to beliefs, which are so basically views about things, adopted beliefs, and saying it's true, it must be true because I believe it so strongly. If I didn't believe it so strongly, it wouldn't be true. And this kind of circular reasoning that people have, and inability to entertain the idea that they might possibly be wrong. So this is a very important skill, leave it a meditational skill or simply basic mental health, that we need to be standing back, examining our views, not just for their correctness, but to reassess our relationship to the views that we hold. We're of course free to hold any view that we wish to hold, but we should beware of that attachment to views and that irrational kind of protection of views. And this occurs in every field. I mean, if any of you studied the history of science, you know that in any era, the most serious opponents to scientific progress tend to be the leaders of the scientific community, who want to protect their theories, their discoveries, their fame, and even in the realm of science, which we like to think of as being sort of a very rational, cool-minded endeavor, is in fact infected by these same kind of powers of craving and conceit and views as any other area of human life. So the effort to be mindful and to be present to our experience is very important, but it's not just this kind of fuzzy just be here now, but we also need to be using these particular tools and being able to take the groups of dhammas, both the unwholesome dhammas and the wholesome dhammas that the Buddha was pointing to, and using those as a map to look at ourselves and said, yes, can I see that within me? What is the nature of craving that, as I experience it in my daily life, where does it cause me to suffer? Am I happy with that level of suffering? Do I want to do something about it? Can I see the conceit? Can I see the attachment to views? How can I find a way to reduce or eliminate those things? Okay, so that's the discourse that I would like to share with you this afternoon. And now if you would like to stretch your legs for 5 minutes, then we'll invite you to come back and we'll have a period of sitting meditation.